Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
June 17th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a great show for you today. We are going to speak to Robert Anello of Morvillo Abramowitz about the FIFA indictment in a moment. But first, please remember to take a minute when you have a chance and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/talkinlaw. Remember, no G in talking, T-A-L-K-I-N, law. Facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. You can send me an email if you have a guest to suggest, a comment about the show, a question, whatever. I want to hear from you. Send me an email at talkinlaw@gmail.com, talkinlaw@gmail.com. You can listen to all our prior episodes at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw, or you can check us out on iTunes. And do us a favor, if you check us out on iTunes, give us a nice review. That helps us out. All righty. What are we going to do today? First, we are going to do the question of the day about racketeering conspiracy law. Then we are going to speak to Robert Anello of Morvillo Abramowitz Grand Ison Anello PC, who will talk to us about the so-called FIFA indictment pending in Brooklyn Federal Court against 14 defendants involved in the business of international soccer who are accused of a racketeering conspiracy based upon involvement in a criminal enterprise. Mr. Anello will break that down for us. Then we will answer the question of the day. And after the question of the day is answered, we will go to Beth Karras of KarrasOnCrime.com for an update on the James Holmes Colorado movie theater shooter trial and the reversal in the Georgia Supreme Court of the Hemi Newman conviction, which was reversed based upon the admission of privileged material. Now for the question of the day. Question: what are the elements of a federal criminal RICO conspiracy charge? One person who knows the answer to that question, but I'm sure will not give it away, is Robert J. Anello of Morvillo Abramowitz Grand Ison and Anello PC. Bob is a well-known longtime white-collar criminal defense lawyer and civil litigator in New York. He is a past president of the Federal Bar Council. Bob is the author of White Collar Crime, Business and Regulatory Offenses, and a White Collar Crime columnist for the New York Law Journal, which I read often, as well as for Forbes.com. On June 8th, Bob published a column on Forbes.com entitled Fee, Fa, Fo, Fum, Who Gets to Prosecute Non-Americans? You can find out all about Bob's firm at maglaw.com, maglaw.com. Without further ado, Bob, are you with me?
I am with you. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing great. And so our listeners know, I met Robert J. Anello 20 years ago, actually. I don't even know if you remember, when I was a summer associate at your firm. And I actually still remember working with you on a civil appeal, which I don't remember the details of, but I remember we worked on an appeal together, and I thank you for your patience with a young summer associate, soon-to-be lawyer, and, you know, it's nice to have mentors like you to help a young lawyer grow into the business. So I'm glad you're with me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you were with us 20 years ago, and I'm happy to join you today again.
Great. So Bob, let's get into it. Let's talk about this FIFA indictment. There are 14 defendants charged. There are officials of international soccer. There are marketing executives. This case is pending before Judge Deary in federal court in Brooklyn. For anybody who's interested in further details, they can go to the web or to Pacer, and they could see it at USA v. Jeffrey Webb under indictment 15 CR 0252. So can you simplify this a little bit, because the indictment is more than 160 pages long. It contains 47 different counts: racketeering, money laundering, wire fraud, conspiracies. Can you give us the cliff notes on this big indictment?
Well, the cliff notes are that there is the racketeering is just a way of sort of bringing all the charges together and suggesting that, at least in the eyes of the grand jury and the Eastern District prosecutors, that FIFA has been engaged in a pattern of conduct that violates the law for a number of years. And that's sort of what the overriding allegation is. The pattern of activity involves essentially paying to get your to get access to the folks at FIFA to have them choose your country. I mean, that's as the site for the soccer games. And if you read the indictment, it does read a little bit like a novel. There are allegations that payoffs have been made over the years for a number of by a number of countries to get them to be chosen. Most recently, Russia and South Africa. There are individuals who, it is said, basically put their vote up for sale. And basically went to the highest bidder and said, if your country wants to host the World Cup, you'll pay me some money. And there are stories that of not just wire transfers and the like that were used, but actual cash payments and cash being left in hotel rooms in order to influence the decision of the particular judges. So that's the overall issue here. Obviously, the interesting issue is while every few years we get excited by the World Cup here, we're really not known as a soccer nation. And if you look at some of the criticism of this prosecution, it's by none other than Mr. Putin, who thinks that we stuck our nose where it doesn't belong. There are others who are very excited by the fact that Loretta Lynch has chosen to try to clean up the sport a little bit. So obviously, yeah, it's different views depending on where you sit. Russia thinks we're just sour grapes, and other countries, including I think the Swiss, where a lot of these folks were arrested, think that this is not such a bad way to clean up a sport that they hold dear to them.
And Bob, just so our listeners are following our conversation, because not everybody who listens to the show is a lawyer, Loretta Lynch is the Attorney General of the United States, who used to be the chief federal prosecutor in Brooklyn. She was a U.S. attorney in Brooklyn until just a short time ago. And her office is responsible for bringing this case, our former office. Before we get to some of those interesting issues about jurisdiction and the like that Mr. Putin is complaining about, you know, generally I think lay people think of racketeering cases, they think of the mob, they think of drug cases. Is there any precedent for a racketeering case being brought in America against an international sports organization?
Well, I don't know if there's precedent for that. I mean, that's sort of, but there is, you know, the racketeering statute has been used extensively in this country for cases that have nothing to do with the mob. It is, it has been used for many legitimate businesses. It has been used in connection with mail fraud. and mail fraud is simply any activity that you engage in with fraud by using the mails or in some way involving the mails. So I don't know that I could identify, and that there may be, but I haven't thought about it and looked at this. I can't identify off the top of my head another one involving an international sports organization. But you should not think of, even though we do, of the RICO racketeering statute as one that involves mobsters alone. I think we all thought that's what it was going to be used for when it was first enacted, but the way the statute is written, it does not require one to be a mobster to be a beneficiary of an indictment.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Robert J. Anello of Morvillo Abramowitz, a white-collar and civil litigation firm in Manhattan. Bob, you know, just so people understand the history of RICO a little bit, as you were just touching upon, I just want to sort of finish that train of thought. You know, I think the RICO statute was developed to combat the mafia and organized crime, but it has really changed the landscape of federal criminal practice, as the government has been able to prosecute enterprises instead of focusing on individuals. What advantage do you think the Racketeering Act gives the government in this particular prosecution?
Well, what it gives you is the ability to bring into the courtroom allegations that go way back. Normally, when you bring a criminal case, you have a statute of limitations that is a 5-year statute of limitations. And if you wanted to prosecute someone and they had a history of bad conduct, that other conduct might not be allowed into the court by the judge. So one of the advantages that RICO has is it allows you to go back as far as you can if you can show that the conduct, even if not the specific conduct you're charging, but if it was part of a pattern, what is known as a pattern of racketeering activity, and you're allowed to sort of group all that activity and show that the organization for years has been operating in this in a systematic manner that broke the law. So Dan, I'm sorry.
I apologize for cutting you off. I was just going to say, and I believe the indictment covers activities that go back about 24 years or so. So it seems like they have used the statute pretty effectively to make it very broad, which they would not have been able to do without the Racketeering Act. But Bob, I want to go on to the excellent article you wrote for Forbes.com, where you talked a bit about, you know, why this case is brought, where it's brought. Should this case have been brought in Brooklyn? Does the United States have any business bringing this case against the International Soccer Organization, which mostly operates in Europe, as far as I can see?
Right. Well, yeah, that is the interesting question. And the U.S., one of the things we seem to do well is prosecute people. I think in many ways, with the envy of the Western world, you see now many cases, if you put FIFA aside, many of the big banking cases that you've seen involve activity that takes place far beyond the shores of the United States. Years ago, you used to see a lot of the big drug cases where all the activity occurred in South America or Central America, yet it had effects in the United States. So the way these kind of cases are done is one of several ways. If the company or the people involved, the enterprise in this case, had any activity in the U.S., then you can charge them here. If it had an effect in the U.S., you might be able to charge them here. In a case like this, or in some of the banking cases, what happens is you transact business in U.S. dollars, and those dollars clear in the United States. So the United States reaches out and takes jurisdiction. That works well in an American court, because the American courts have developed a set of rules that basically say what I just said, that if it either affects the U.S., some activity occurs in the U.S., or if an American or domestic, what we call a domestic concern, is involved in the activity, then it can be prosecuted in the U.S. court. One of the issues that comes up, how do you get the people here? And that's a much more complicated question, because to
Bob, on that point, we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure I get this
sure.
in. A listener named Joel contacted me on Twitter and asked about defendant Jack Warner, who is a Trinidad Tobago politician who is charged in this indictment. And Joel on Twitter wanted to know when Mr. Warner will be arraigned. And Mr. Warner's case is pretty interesting because his sons, I believe, are cooperating in this investigation on behalf of the government. Do you know anything about the status of Mr. Warner's case in particular?
Well, I not personally, except for the reports. Extradition is a difficult, it's both a political and a legal issue. And sometimes people don't get extradited because the government in that country does not want to assist the U.S. Many countries we have different treaties with. They're called mutual legal assistance treaties or extradition treaties that allow us to get people and information from foreign countries. The way I think Mr. Warner's case will play out will very much depend on what the government of Trinidad and Tobago think of this prosecution. So I don't know that you can predict in his case. I think countries like Switzerland, where I think maybe 6 or 7 of the defendants were arrested, are a little bit more predictable. I think the government in this case probably waited for a bunch of people to be in Switzerland before they released the indictment, because Switzerland is a country that I can't say it's the easiest, but at least they're more cooperative with the U.S. in terms of extradition on certain types of cases.
I personally expect that it's going to be some time before we see a trial of any of these defendants in a Brooklyn federal courtroom because of the extradition litigation, which I would expect to occur all over the world where these defendants are. Bob Anello, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back on the show sometime soon.
I'd love
Bob Anello.
You've come a long way. Congratulations. It's a great show.
Thank you so much, Bob. And if you want to learn more about Bob's background, go to maglaw.com. Robert J. Anello, again, thanks so much. I'll speak to you soon, Bob. Okay, now, before we go to Beth Karras, let's go to the question of the day. What are the elements of a federal criminal RICO conspiracy charge? Answer. According to the latest publicly available criminal RICO manual from the United States Department of Justice, to establish a criminal conspiracy violation under 18 United States Code 1962D, which is alleged in count 1 of the FIFA indictment, the United States must prove each of the following 3 elements. 1, the existence of an enterprise, or that an enterprise would exist. That's interesting because they don't have to prove that there was an enterprise, just that if the agreement was completed and carried out, that the enterprise would have existed. 2, that the enterprise was or would be engaged in or its activities affected or would affect interstate or foreign commerce. Remember, folks, that's how the federal government gets jurisdiction. It's the Interstate Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. 3, that each defendant knowingly agreed that a conspirator, which may include the defendant himself, would commit a violation of 18 U.S.C. 1962C, which is one of the substantive sections of the RICO statute. Now, the most recent federal case on the subject of RICO conspiracy elements in the criminal realm is U.S. v. Merritt. 2014 U.S. District Lexus 96993, 2014 case out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, which lays out the elements of a RICO conspiracy somewhat differently than the United States Attorney's Manual. Those interested in that case can find the case at 2014 U.S. District Lexus 96993. But now that we've answered the question of the day, I need Kiss and Beth Karras.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning. Interesting discussion you just had.
I thought so. Any thoughts? Comments?
Well, I didn't hear
concerns?
All of it. I didn't hear all of it, but, you know, I have to believe that the U.S. attorney has considered whether or not all of the offenses in the indictment are extraditable, you know, and whether or not, you know, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about whether these guys are going to, should waive or should fight it.
Yeah, I've seen cases where, you know, the U.S. attorney has bet that the people would be extraditable, and, you know, they're not always correct, or sometimes they take an aggressive position and the elements don't exactly match the extraditing jurisdiction, and some counts don't survive extradition sometimes, so
right. We'll
have to wait and see.
Yep.
But let's get an update on the James Holmes Colorado movie theater shooting trial, which is ongoing. I know you've been following it closely.
Yes. Well, there have been 32 days of trial so far, and it is going to wrap up this week with the state's case in chief, all right, the largely uncontested evidence. Largely, I say, because some of the insanity defense rebuttal evidence is coming in now. I call it rebuttal evidence. Isn't technically it's coming in the state's case in chief, where they're establishing the defendant's sanity. This is an insanity case, and the state was allowed to put on some of the forensic evidence up front to say no, he's sane. He wasn't insane at the time. A high point in the trial, though, was yesterday when the defendant's treating psychiatrist, between March and June of 2012, the shootings was July 20th, 2012, when she took the stand to talk about the James Holmes who walked into her office on March 21st, 2012. The last time she saw him was June 11th when he dropped out of school. But during that time, she saw him seven times, and she did prescribe some meds to him. He wasn't particularly talkative. She found him to have sort of a nervousness where he was very still. He wasn't fidgety. Instead, he was kind of frozen. And he talked about homicidal thoughts from the very first day she met him. He said he was obsessed with thinking about homicide 3 to 4 times a day. It was enough that by the end, by their last visit, when he was dropping out of school, she wanted him to continue treatment. She kind of hoped he would, but he never did. And she had another, a more senior psychiatrist present for the last meeting, or some of the meetings. And she actually violated, knowingly and admittedly, she said on the stand, violated the HIPAA laws, the patient confidentiality laws, by calling his mother to express her concerns. But she didn't tell his mother, living in San Diego, that her son had these homicidal thoughts, but, you know, described other things in his personality. And the mother was like, yeah, well, he's kind of always been a little bit like this. And she also alerted the danger assessment team on campus to check him out, to look into his background. Now, we haven't heard anyone from that team, danger assessment team, including campus police. We haven't heard what they did, but she assumed that they would check into whether or not he was licensed to carry guns or had applied for any guns. He never told her about his plans. He never told her that during the time he was seeing her, he was amassing an arsenal of ballistics gear and ammo and guns and formulating a plan. If he had told her that, the law has requires a therapist, a psychiatrist, to report. There's a duty to warn, but you need specificity. You need a target, and the threat needs to be imminent. And she said he didn't fit the criteria for involuntary commitment for 72 hours, which would have been more than a month before the incident. But he had never disclosed any of that to her. Nonetheless, she did violate HIPAA by telling some people about her concerns regarding his dangerousness.
So, Beth, do you think that this sort of cries out for some kind of change in the law so that if a person like Holmes is expressing these homicidal thoughts, which perhaps don't cross the threshold to committing somebody to a psychiatric facility, perhaps there should be some kind of surveillance of the person to prevent this in the future?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, you need to actually have the power to do some, you know, if you have to go into court and get, you know, subpoenas, whatever, to look into a person, perhaps, you need to be able to do that, even if the threat isn't imminent, but at least do what this assessment team should, or maybe we'll hear what they did, but I can't believe that they checked into guns and found that, you know, and did a thorough check. But they should be able to do some surveillance. However, you're talking about resources here also. You know, and departments are spread thin. They're like, well, you know, there are a lot of people who express dangerousness, but they're a danger to themselves, and we can't surveil a person inside their home, and are they going to kill themselves? You know, we'll do the best we can. You know, I just don't know, without an imminent threat, how much people will really respond. It's easy for us to sit here and say this is what should happen, but putting it into, you know, the practical application can be problematic. I'm not saying you shouldn't try, but it does seem there should be some change. Colorado has, the state has committed millions of dollars into mental health care and to be more proactive to try to prevent something like this. But I don't know how much of that millions of dollars has gone into what we're talking about.
You're listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Beth Karas of KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, we only have about a minute left. Let's quickly give our listeners an update on this Georgia Supreme Court reversal of a conviction in another case involving murder and psychiatric evidence. There was an admission, I believe, of some privileged information. Tell us why that Supreme Court took that action.
Yeah, and this would involve Hemi Newman, a General Electric manager who was convicted in 2012. The jury rejected his insanity defense but found him guilty but mentally ill. He killed his lover's husband, although she's always denied the affair, and he's going to get a retrial. The Georgia High Court reversed his conviction 6-1 because they said the records and reports of two people who evaluated him in jail, a mental health assessment, should not have been admitted into the trial by the prosecution. The defense had objected because apparently, you know, they said, look, this was an assessment by two people we never intended to call as witnesses. This was work product, attorney-client privilege, and the court agreed. But the dissenter, I kind of understand where the dissenter's coming from. It's like, wait a second. In jail, he signed a waiver saying he knows anything said here could be used in court. He knows that the privilege is waived. And I thought, well, if it's a privileged material, why is it in the prosecution's hands? Why did you turn it over?
Beth, we'll have to explore this interesting Hemi Newman, Georgia case on a later show. Thank you so much, Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Now, I want to thank Robert J. Anello of Morvillo Abramowitz, maglaw.com, Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Check out her subscription site. It's worth it. My producer, who produced another great show for us today. Next week will be a fantastic show, June 24th, with the always entertaining Murray Richmond. Don't worry, Murray, King of the Bronx. Join us. Don't miss that show. I want to wish everybody peace and justice. Until next time, I'm Dan Hochheiser.